My name is Benji de la Piedra. I am 30 years old, born and raised in Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. I am in D.C. now. I'm a visiting fellow at a scholar center at the Library of Congress, the John W. Kluge Center for Scholars. My work straddles like practical hands-on interviewing oral history work. And out of that, like kind of a further leg of that is like teaching oral history and interviewing skills in different kinds of settings, from semester-long graduate level seminars to like, you know, one-off or a three-session, you know, community workshop for instance, the DC Oral History Collaborative, which is actually funded by, and all the workshops take place at branches of the DC Public Library. Also, I do a lot of basically scholarly work, historical documentation and like literary theorizing. Most of my scholarly work is biographical, or kind of takes biographical, like it coalesces around biographies or radiates out of specific intellectual biographies. So three African-American intellectuals in particular tend to guide everything I do and push everything I do, and they are Ralph Ellison, Albert Murray, and Herbert Denton Jr. Denton is the least known of those three. He was a journalist at the Washington Post, and I've been researching his biography through both oral history methods and more traditional archival documentary library-based kind of methods for the past 8 years. I frame Herb Denton in cosmic terms, and we can talk about what that means. What is cosmic? Because that could also mean nothing, but I do think that there's something I'm into. So the idea of like Herbert Denton's cosmos is what I'm interested in documenting and interpreting as his biographer.
I have a few questions,
yeah,
which maybe will seem off topic, but I don't think they are. But I want to know more about the cosmos.
Yeah. So, okay, yeah, I'm glad you asked. So, Albert Murray, one of my three guys, he has this idea, basically, of what he calls Cosmos Murray. So he's basically talking about how, as not even just as a Black intellectual, this is like a person in the world, he was raised to believe that he really could be like an heir with an H-E-I-R, like heir to like all of the world's culture ever. And that what it takes to like absorb that culture is like all the qualities of a good student. And basically cosmos, and he literally in this essay, he says like, the term is like cosmos, and then in brackets, the word you. Right, like cosmos, like who is Cosmos K? Like Cosmos K is, yeah, like the entire world of connections and contexts and like, yeah, all of the different worlds, universes, you could say, that a single life like fits into. And so, yeah, Murray has this idea, and I think it's especially potent when we're talking about Black intellectuals or people from, I guess you could call like subaltern communities, like this idea that, yeah, like that minority identity or subaltern identity is not a limitation on the access that that person can have towards culture of any kind. I also, when I talk about cosmic, I'm getting it from my partner, Christine, for 10 years was a mathematics teacher, like a middle school math teacher. And she is trained in Montessori style education specifically for adolescents, which is unusual. Most Montessorians are elementary school teachers, and that's only because Dr. Montessori died before she could write her book on adolescent education. But Montessori's whole philosophy of education is what she calls cosmic education, that the purpose of an education is to allow the learner to discover what Montessori calls their cosmic task, like to discover that task, like that sense of a life's purpose, and then to have the tools and develop the capacity to carry out that cosmic task. Yeah, and even the word, I mean, the word cosmopolitanism is something I've been into for a long time. Again, this idea that like, you know, as human beings, we exist to like be exposed to as much culture as we can, you know, and that we shouldn't draw stark boundaries around the kind of culture that we should try to learn from, just because of what is expected of us, because of a stereotype or what's familiar or something. So yeah, that idea of like a really I don't know if limitless is the word, but maybe a kind of like a limitless universe of what there is to learn and what there is to. And I know this word is obviously very politically charged these days, but I mean this in a very positive sense, like to appropriate, like what is, what one can make one's own. Yeah, what is a cosmic library? It would be a repository and catalyst of knowledge, or like a repository of knowledge and a catalyst of appropriations of knowledge that is like sufficiently vast to like equip the learner to take their own cosmic journeys, right? But the idea of the journey is also super important, like thinking cosmic, like it's, you know, you're heading out into like the unknown, right? And so yeah, that idea that like this knowledge can give you what you need in order to travel great distances, something like that. I'm sure there's like way better ways to put this, but that's what's coming to mind for now, at least, is
have you ever encountered a library like that in real life?
I mean, the Library of Congress is kind of, it's I would say the closest I've ever come to experiencing that. It's funny because I'm also thinking about like the role that aesthetics play. Like if you go into the main reading room of the Library of Congress, it's stunning. Yeah. Like I love being in that room, right? Like, and it's funny actually, because I was just in there yesterday. You look up, like when you go in and you look all the way up, and you know, cathedrals do the same, they have the same effect, you know, like big mosques have the same effect. It's like that literally the space like has an effect on you. And so you look up and in the Library of Congress, main reading room, like there's this like mosaic that has basically like the 12 cultures, which are probably seen as like the 12 greatest cultures or whatever, like each represented. Like 10 of those 12 are European cultures, and then there's like Islam is in there, and I don't know what else, but like 10 or 11, it's like France, Rome, Spain, you know, it's like basically, yeah, Europe, and then like the East as Islam. So yeah, is that representative? Of course not. Does it reflect what was seen as like the known world that was like worth knowing for those people? Like, yes. And even as like contaminated as that idea might be, or as limited as it is, again, I think there is something to that impulse to say like, you know, let's think beyond our culture. I don't know. I could say that in a better way, I think. But anyways, that's kind of what's coming to mind. So yeah, I mean, the Library of Congress has 2 copies of every book, like ever, pretty much, you know, maybe not published around the world, but certainly published in the US. I would say for the most part, anything from like the Western world, you can get at the Library of Congress. Library of Congress has the largest collection of maps in the world, 5.6 million maps. You know what I mean? Just like the amount of like material is pretty astounding. So again, this idea of like access. And it's funny because like as I'm talking about this, like I can't help but for some reason I'm thinking about like, you know, like the early promise of the internet was like, oh, we're gonna have this unfettered access to all this knowledge and it's gonna be great. And that's like all we're gonna need, right? And obviously the internet, you know, we can pose serious questions as to whether it's done more harm than good. But again, I think there's something about that dream of having like access to and kind of like instant recall.
Do you think there's a difference between access to knowledge and like catalyst for knowledge appropriation?
Yeah, I think catalyst. Yeah, I do, because I think with the access, to me, access is like the name for a situation in which like if you know to go look for it, like you can find it, right? Mm-hmm. I have access to more material than I could ever count or know what to do with at the Library of Congress because of the catalog, right? Is the catalog like the most intuitive and kind of easiest thing to use? No. So as a catalyst, it might be falling short, right? At least for me, right? I don't want to piss anybody off by saying this. I love the Library of Congress.
I don't think you know.
But I'm not great at navigating databases, you know? And so I think And I think about this in the same way, actually, with oral history. There was a time when, like, my big idea, kind of the thing I kept, like, repeating in conferences and stuff was, like, that, like, oral historians, like, fundamentally what we do is build collections of interviews. And that part of building a collection is building pathways into the collection and pathways, like, out of the collection, right? Like, how to get that material into, like, other streams of culture and in the hands of other people, right? And so, yeah, to me, it's like the access is like the collection itself. And then the catalyst would be kind of the different mechanisms and avenues that you create to like give people the opportunity to really engage with it and appropriate it, make it their own,